And so anyway, McNamara in 64, 65, 65, we were having trouble recruiting like we are now. And he lowered the minimum threshold. It was called Project 100,000. And the idea was to get young boys who would otherwise were not qualified because of inability to basically get past third grade English, were put into the military. And it was largely minority, but an awful lot of farm kids. And this group that was responsible, it was called Charlie Company, of a task force called Task Force Barker that were attached to a useless, one of the worst divisions in the military called the AmeriCal Division. It was a division in which all the junk heaps went. About sometime early this summer, the CIA dramatically increased the number of people on the Iranian The Iranian Operational Group, IO, whatever it is. They had one for the Iraqi war. The group that met every day to discuss Iran suddenly was going to be augmented by 100%. And every division in the CIA was supposed to give up 10 of their people. And one of my friends who was involved when they passed the word that we want 10 people from every division, and this is the clandestine action, in what they call the covert operational area, not the academic area. This is the area of operators. We had to give up 10 people to the Iranians because we're beefing it up. And what my friend said to me, most of us, he was a division leader, he said, we love it because we can empty the drunk tank. You know, we just go get the most useless guys and shove them in. And in any case, so this is a little bit like this unit of sort of guys that couldn't get it otherwise. They got through basic training. They get to Vietnam in late December of 67, 68. They start patrolling. They spend about until the middle of March. They lose about 15 to 20% of their people. Snipers. They even have bungee pits in the jungle sometimes. Mostly snipers and bombs. 20%. They never see an enemy. And eventually, as they go along, eventually, inevitably, what happens is, particularly with bad leadership, the people began to take it. They take it out in the people a little bit. You slug an old man if he moves out of your way when you're going through a village because you're looking for combat soldiers. You can't find anybody. You can't find anybody. And one time early in the war, one of the generals announced that we're fighting the Viet Cong. He announced, the commanding general of the 82nd, I think it was, Airborne, he announced they were fighting in the highlands. He said, all right, men, these guys, the guerrillas we're fighting, they're farmers by day, guerrillas at night. So after that, they go through a village. Anybody who yawned, they started shooting at. So they had us remand that. They would literally shoot at you, yawn, there's a gorilla, bam, bam, bam. I mean, it's just that happens in war. So they were increasingly angry, increasingly frustrated. Losing a military is all about, as a soldier, I was a grunt. I was what they call a straight leg 111 infantryman in my lost youth. It's all about loyalty, the buddy next to you. You go fight. Not, you know, basically, it's the flag has nothing to do with it. It's your buddy. You're going to go. When he dies, you're mad. Or he gets hurt, you're mad. And so a lot of guys got hurt. And March 15th, they're told, tomorrow you're going to meet the enemy for the first time. We know, we have intelligence that there's a major unit there in this place called, it was called Pinkville, they called it. It was My Lai Phor, the village. And so the kids do what they did at the time. The GIs toked it up. And the officers and the senior enlisted guys drank it up. But they did get up at 3 or 4 in the morning to kill and be killed. And they jumped on choppers and they went to the village. No troops there. Instead, they found 560. As I say, that's how many bodies were exhumed. It's a lot more than the 200 or 300 most people think. Women, children, old men making breakfast, charcoal fires or whatever. And for some inexplicable reason, I hope it's inexplicable. It could be explicable, but I'm not sure. That would suggest that it happened more. For some reason, they gathered them into three ditches and they began to shoot them. And they shot them all day. It was one of the horrible massacres. There was a photographer there who had two sets. He was there for the Army newspaper, the Stars and Stripes, with the camera the Army gave him, a black and white. He took propaganda pictures of soldiers looking like the right thing. With the other camera, he took 4 or 5 rolls of color pictures. What really happened? After I wrote the stories, he sold them to Life magazine for $100,000. I mean, smart guy, I guess. I don't know what else you'd call him. I don't like him. I naturally wouldn't like him. Anyway. So they executed everybody. Just stood there and they put them in ditches. And the farm boy shot. One kid in particular was named Paul Meadlow. And these are the M1 rifles. I think they had clips of 16, semi-automatic. You had to keep the finger pressed. You know, it wasn't like a real machine gun. But semi-automatic, you fire a lot of rounds and boom, just sort of constantly pressing. And then you put another clip in. And among the farm kids, who did it. He was one. He was 17 from a small city in Indiana. He shot a lot. When I later spent a lot of time not only doing stories in a book about it, but about how it was covered up, institutionally covered up. Everybody, of course, knew about it in the system, and everybody did a sort of massive lying, which is not unsurprising, sort of normal for any system. But the Hispanic and black kids, which were much more of a minority then, particularly the blacks were more dominant than Hispanics, a lot of them, I think I must have talked about 15 or 20 of them, maybe as many as 8 or 9 told me they fired high. They didn't dare not shoot. But damn it, this was Whitey's war. And, you know, they didn't dare not shoot because if they were seen not shooting, they would get killed perhaps by one of their buddies. But the Whitey's war, and they had nothing to do with it. And later, some of them wore black armbands for a couple of weeks afterwards. But that's incidental. My sample isn't that strong. But I have a hunch there was some division on it. In any case, so they shoot everybody. And at one point, they were in ditches. They were put in 3 large ditches, and they did a lot of shooting to make sure everybody died. We're talking about 150 or 200 in each ditch. And at one point, when it was over, they heard a keening noise. And from the bottom of the ditch, some kid, about 2 or 3, his mother had tucked him somehow in some way that protected him. He came crawling up through the bodies full of other people's blood, climbed on top of the pile of the ditch. And everything I'm telling you now is in every record. What I'm telling you now is in the record. And it was in the stories I wrote because I had it very early, but it turned out in all the various investigations, it's in the official records. He began running across the patio, what you will. We always, the cliche is a rice paddy, but he began running across. And Lieutenant Kelly, who was the man that had been doing, has been fingered by the world as the great officer who was in charge of everything, a very ordinary second lieutenant, first lieutenant then, one of 6 who was leading the shooting, but he became sort of the point for everybody in the subsequent histories. Kelly said to this man, Meadlow, the farm boy, who'd been doing sort of an automatic shooting, he said, plug him. And Meadlow just couldn't do it. Tama won. And Kelly, with great contempt, as everybody recounted, took officers then had a smaller rifle known as a carbine, ran up behind the kid and shot him in the back of the head with his carbine. So the next day, they're on a patrol. They went to sleep. They got up, and they were patrolling in the area, as we did. And Paul Meadlow stepped on a landmine, and his foot was blown off to his knee, the right foot, right below the knee. And they called in what they call a medevac, a chopper to come, American chopper to come take him away from the war zone. And as he was lying there waiting, he began to utter a curse, an oath. God has punished me, Lieutenant Kelly, and God will punish you. God is, and he kept on as a mantra, and everybody, I was a freelance writer in 69, I heard about it. And I had covered the war for years for the Associated Press. And I even left. I was so rattled by the war, so convinced that the war was such a wrong that I quit journalism in 1968 to work for Senator Eugene McCarthy, who was running against the war, the only Democrat who would run against it. And I was a speechwriter, and I became his press secretary, and I was sort of vigilantly, and everybody told me, I'm dead in journalism. You can't do that. You can't cross this barrier between press and politics, which is done all the time now. But then I was a real risky thing to do, but he was going to, he took on the war as a moral issue. He was a Jesuit, and a really rigorous Jesuit. I mean, he really, I was his Jewish press secretary, and I wasn't allowed to tell anybody he went to Mass every morning. He considered religion his private business, and his best buddies were bishops. He'd gone to a seminary, and it's a fascinating time in history. He just was a man who saw the war in a way that nobody sees it now in America. He saw it as a moral wrong. And that word has disappeared from the political lexicon. Not here. There's a lot of talk about Amnesty International, for which I'm speaking. I mean, they always speak truth to power, and they always worry about morality, which is the reason I'm here, because of what that group does and what it represents. Human Rights Watch also. They're not alone. There are a lot of other people. But we don't talk about morality. Anyway, so Meadlow is uttering this curse. And what happened is I learned about Milai, and I ran and found the kids. I began running around the country. You ever see those ads? I'm American Express, those ads, you know, the famous ads for American Express. And I just got an American Express card. And I just keep on thinking when I see these ads about people talking about how American Express, you know, I'm American Express, helped me expose the Milai massacre. It's not an ad they're going to do. But I had no money, and I was just billing it on my card, flying around, because I had no money. I was, you know, a hand-to-mouth kid, 69. You know, gas costs 25 cents a gallon, and heating oil is 18 cents. So you can make a living on a couple hundred bucks a week, or less. Anyway, so nobody tells me about me. I've written a couple of stories, and I'm syndicating these stories. No newspaper would publish it, even though I'd been press secretary of president, written for all the major magazines, was a pretty well-known freelancer. I'd been a senior AP correspondent covering the war. They knew me, and I wasn't lacking for freelance work, but nobody would run it. So we set up a news agency, an independent news agency, sort of a shrewd move. A friend of mine was deeply involved, a really smart guy who's now naturally a Hollywood mogul. And we set up a independent, and we got a lawyer to vet it, a good lawyer to vet it competently, and we syndicated it. So newspapers are just buying a news agency story. They weren't publishing something on their own. With one level of responsibility removed. And it worked. People were publishing the stories, but the kids I talked to, for weeks, I was running around doing story after story, and sort of the whole press corps was sort of going, oh, what's he going to do next? And they waited. Sort of like Abu Ghraib, I did the same thing then. But what happened was, one person told me about Milo, what happened. And what a story. What an amazing story. He sits there and he's screaming, God will punish me. And finally the chopper takes him away. So I go looking for Milo. The good thing was, the bad thing was, no Google, no search engine. The good thing was, it was M-E-A-D-L-O, somewhere in Indiana. I found him. I was calling. Those days, you could get information free. I was in Salt Lake City when I learned this. And I spent, half a night calling every local exchange. I finally found a Milo, called up, and spent most of the day. I got a very rural voice, a woman, and I said, I'm looking for Paul Milo. She said, well, he's next door. So I told her what I was doing. I'm a reporter. I want to talk to your son. She said, I don't know if he'll talk to you. I said, how's his leg? She said, not so good. You know, it hurts and whatever. So I'm coming. So I flew wherever, all night. I remember flying. Paul Milo lived in a town called New Goshen, Indiana, which is below Terre Haute, which is below Indianapolis, which is below Chicago. Believe me, it was hard. I got to rent a car. I got to Terre Haute. I had no idea. It was a chicken farm. I finally pull in. I don't know if any of you remember Norman Rockwell, the American iconic painter who paints all these pictures of rural life in America, sort of idyllic. This was not rural life in America. This was a chicken farm with no man around, run down. It was a shack near the Wabash River in the deep south, really. The Ku Klux Klan was operating in southern Indiana until the late 50s. I mean, it was really a rural south. And the cages were all messed up. And you could just see no man. And the house, there was the cages, and there was this ratty house. And I pull up in front of it, and out walks the old lady, the lady I talked with the night before. She's maybe 50, but she looks 70. And she comes up to me, and I have my little ratty suit on, and I pretend to be a journalist, which I am. I walk out, and I introduce myself, and I say, can I see him? She says, well, I don't know if he'll talk to you, but he's in there. And she pointed to the shack that was their home. And then, this lady, this rural lady, said to me, quote, unquote, she said, I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer. Okay? Wow. Flash forward 35 years. I'm doing Abu Ghraib. And I'm now at the New Yorker, which is very exalted, with elaborate checking procedures. And I get this great story, with this wonderful general who did a report that was dazzling. No question. This is. I thought this was going to be... it doesn't matter what I thought. We ran the story. We do the story, and I keep on going because I know this comes from on high. Again, heuristically, you don't do what we're doing unless it's on high. Too many people knew. There were too many people at Abu Ghraib. Too many people watched what was going on. This humiliation. It's all part of breaking down prisoners. Really what it was part of, the idea was we had nobody inside. And what you want to do is you want to get some of these young males we captured. We want to put them in a position where we photograph them nude. In the Quran it says twice, you cannot show a nude. Man cannot show his nudity to another man. Let alone to, you know, you cannot do it. You go to any sports club in Cairo, private showers. If there's a collective shower in the sports club, everybody wears shorts. And a Westerner, you wear shorts out of just respect for their beliefs. And so the idea was, I think the intellectual idea is we were going to break down and get incriminating evidence on some of these guys and send them back home and tell them to find the insurgency and join it and then tell us what's going on, or we'll show these parents to their schoolmates and the woman in the neighborhood, and they'll be ruined forever, which they would be given the mores. You know, that's the society that operates on shame. We operate here on guilt. You know, it's, but whatever. It may have been the idea. It's all lost in what happened. So I'm doing this story, and I'm convinced Rumi's involved. I'm convinced it goes to the top. I have a lot of reason to be convinced. You get in this funny situation. I have paper I can't use because the people that gave it to me would be burned forever. So I can't do it. But I know where it goes. So I'm writing away. And in between, because The New Yorker is great to me, I'm their pimp during the week. The magazine's on the newsstand. I'm doing interviews, selling the magazine. That's part of the job. So I've done two stories. I'm doing a third. For some of you don't know The New Yorker. Everything is fact-checked. And the final version, when you're finally closing the it's a weekly, and it's finally being closed, very high production values. I mean, they independently check everything. So it was just the whole magazine must have been crashing on all these things. But the last person you meet is the grammarian. And I was telling somebody earlier, you seriously have conversations about parallelism and long discussions about, you know, in a panic, I'm so tired and I got other stories I want to write. Doing three stories in 3 weeks in The New Yorker is, I assure you, it's never been done. Spot stories. I mean, they've done long treatments, but I can tell you it's never been done because you're having long conversations about whether we should do comma here or comma there, and I just want out, but you have to do it. I mean, that's the game. You have to really talk about whether it should be an it or a they. Anyway, you get through it, and I'm on a radio talk show, charging away, and I'm on an NPR, National Public Radio, national show like you have here. You're very fine. You have this. The Irish radio is great. They always hound me. They're always calling me in America, and I respect them for that, although I don't always cooperate. that's the way it goes. And so a woman calls up on this. She said, I have a child that was in the unit that did all this bad stuff, and nobody will talk to me. I tried to call the government. They won't talk to me, and there's all sorts of problems. I went to the New York Times. Nobody returns the phone call. So I just said on the air, one of those things you just do, I said, got a pencil? Figure people listening to talk radio in the afternoon, aren't sitting there at a typewriter or a computer. And I gave her my phone number. And sure enough, I got not that many crank calls. There were a lot of calls, people wanting my number, but of course nobody gave it out in the various stations. This was on all over the American network for NPR, National Public Radio. And a couple of days later, she called me, and I scoot up to where she is, somewhere in Northeast America. And she is, interestingly enough, a very devout Catholic who supported the war totally. She had a child. There was a child involved. I'm going to fudge. But it's just fudging, just for the sake of fudging. I could say everything, but it wouldn't matter here. But I just do it. There was a child involved who'd been in the unit that was doing the horrible stuff and had come home early. They sent the unit home early, maybe not, I don't know. And the child, before the stories came out, nobody knew anything. She's in a unit. The child comes home. She's in the Army Reserve, and she's in a military police unit. She's basically part of a group. And this is lower middle class America, and what the child was doing was getting extra money, maybe for a hairdo or to go to beauty school or what. Not that they're not as bright as anybody else, but they were totally disadvantaged, the people in this particular unit. They came from rural West Virginia area. And one of the people with the thumbs up and thumbs down was the night manager of a pizza parlor. They were all reservists called to active duty for the war. And they initially were directing traffic in Baghdad, and they were reassigned, given a couple of weeks training, and sent to this most sophisticated, complicated prison, Abu Ghraib, which had incredible stigma. It was the torture prison for Saddam, which we kept for some reason. Only, you know, dumber than dumb. And so she'd come home early. The mother couldn't figure out what was going on. A changed person. She had been married before she left. She came home, left her husband, left the family, stopped talking, moved to another house, and was inconsolable. Just completely in severe black depression, really. That wasn't a word that she would use. But she just disappeared, moved, had a different job. And so I show up, and here's the story. Nobody knew what was going on. She came back about a month and a half before the stories broke about her unit. It was her unit that she had been in. And this woman took a newspaper. When the first stories came out, it was huge. The pictures of the guy in the mask and, you know, standing up in the chair. And she knocked on the door, and the daughter answered the door and slammed it when she showed her the picture. Is this it? Is this what happened? So then she tried to talk to people in the government. Nobody would talk to her. And she went to the media. Nobody talked to her because here's what she did. All the kids in combat duty in Iraq, I'm sure the British soldiers too. I don't know if Irish soldiers were there. I don't think so. The British soldiers, one of the things, because Iraq is so unfun, no R&R, everybody brings a DVD player. They all manage, even the poorest of family manage to glom onto something that they can watch movies and play war games in the off time. And that's what they do. Everybody had a DV player. And when the child came home, right away, before all this stuff broke, before she began acting out, she left the computer. And it was at this point, the woman said, she decided to look at the computer. I've told her, I tease her a lot about the unconscious and Freud. She says, absolutely not. She needed another computer for her office. It had nothing to do with anything. I don't believe it. I think she wanted to see what was in the computer. She opened up the computer and began deleting files. She was going to take it to her office. She was a salesperson. Began deleting files. And there was a file marked Iraq. And she hits this button and outpours 80 pictures of a naked man standing in front of prison bars, hand behind his head. You'll remember this photograph. Two Belgian shepherds. We call them wrongly German shepherds, for which the New Yorker got 7,000 letters, I'm sure. Two Belgian shepherds 3 feet away, snarling at him, foaming, you know, ready to go. And we published the one photograph of the man standing there, not even protecting his private parts. He had to keep his hand behind his head. I'm sure some of you remember it. It was just a famous photograph. But here's what the sequence was. In the sequence, the dogs were let loose at him. And he was bitten in a terrible place, and there was blood all over. And they ended with some hand trying to hand sew the stitches. No doctor, just one of the people, some soldier trying to sew it up. And it was, the New Yorker's position is, you can't, it wasn't about protecting anybody, it's how much can you humiliate the Arab. And the army's been beaten to death already in this story. It's not a question of protecting. We only ran the one photograph. And it was just a nightmare. So she wanted me to have this. And so we worked out a deal. It was very complicated because I had to get permission from the child. And I also had to somehow convey to the mother, this kid needed to be treated immediately. She was in a suicidal depression, I would gather. I'm not competent to say that. But I knew that I had great leverage on her. I needed the child's permission to publish the picture. And by depicting, anyway, it's just the ethical issues were really interesting in a funny way. And some people do worry about it. I had such a power position in terms of, we ended up doing the right thing. We got permission from her, and we got her, I'm sure she got her into some sort of immediate treatment because she was really at the edge. So we became friends, I and this woman, because she was an amazing, amazing gutsy lady. She had there had been a divorce, and she had a boyfriend that didn't want to do any of this, and she was sort of, she just did the right thing. She was just, the morality was great. Year go by. I'm giving a speech somewhere in the area, and I take her for dinner. And she tells me this story that she said she hadn't told me. She said that when the kid came back, moved away, a beautiful child, she said, left her husband, every weekend she began to get tattooed. And she would get bigger and bigger and larger tattoos. Eventually, all her body was tattooed up to the neck. It was, she said, again, quote unquote, as if she was trying to change her skin. So what I posit is this, as bad as it is, and I'm not even talking about the incredible destruction to Iraqi society and the chaos and deaths and the psychological damage of young children living the last 6 years, not only having to put up with Saddam, but having to put up with us for the last 3-4 years of whatever insanity we do. We in America are going to really be paid back for all of this. We have about 1.5 million troops circulating through there. And I'm telling you right now, some of you know what Ambien is. It's 2 or 3 Ambien for the kids to get through the night, any of them. We are going to pay dearly. So we haven't begun to see, let alone World War III macro. In the micro level, it's going to be devastating. And it's just, so you just sit here and it's just an overwhelming sadness. And we can wait, we can count. But he's going to be president until noon on January 20, 2009. And until then, I'm not breathing easily. Let's do questions. And I'm sorry it took so long. Thank you. You're a great audience. Thank you. Okay. We're going to make this short. I don't think there's a night plane in New York tonight, is there? So I've got a little while, but I'm going to get you out of here soon so you don't stay too long, not past 9. Let's go.
Okay, can I start then?
You can start.
Yeah. You said that you don't know when,
oh, no,
perhaps,
of course not.
Rather than if,
right.
President Bush is going to decide his surgical strikes in
I'd say if. I'll make it
but,
if.
But, I mean, he's there for another year. Mm-hmm. He's a man who believes with a religious fervor in what he's doing. Wouldn't it make sense that if he's going to strike, he's going to strike before he leaves office?
Of course.
So do you think he's going to do that?
It doesn't matter what I think. I don't know that he's going to do it. He has not signed an execute order. I know he wants to. I know the word that people inside use is messianic. Mm. You know, and I honestly don't know. I don't know why. I don't understand the man. I don't know whether he's doing what he's doing because he thinks God is talking to him, or his father didn't do it, or it's a step 13 in a 12-step recovery program. I just don't know.
And if a Republican wins the next election, or indeed if Hillary Clinton wins the next election, do you think that policy towards Iran is going to change?
I don't think it has to. I think it must. I mean, look, again, you're asking me a question of really what if, and my opinion is no more valid. I mean, I don't know anything above what I've said and written. So with that caveat, which is saying to you that it's completely useless information I'm going to give you, I think they will have to change the policy and the next president will have to engage. He just will have to engage. And why there isn't more pressure on this one to engage is sort of amazing to me. He will have to engage. And he would be enormously successful if he did engage, because everybody in the Middle East is in a panic about this. Nobody, you know, look, America has a lot of bombs and guns, and nobody wants us there to be killing them.
Can I put an idiot question to you before I go to the audience? Because they will ask very intelligent questions, so I just want to ask one. It always strikes me as quite extraordinary that the United States is so dependent on oil. Its whole economy is so dependent on oil. Why doesn't it try harder to understand and be friendly with the people who have most of the oil,
who are the Muslims? Absolutely, the great question. It's not an all. It's what my friends in the Middle East. One of the things you do with somebody like me is I make a lot of contacts among oil people, particularly, for example, Total was deeply involved in Iraq, deeply involved in the Middle East, and very so. The senior people at Total really know a lot, and they have a very special relationship with their government. And there's a lot of information shared. Why? We're so dependent on that oil, and why we choose to pick a war with them, and why you wouldn't mind, you'd say to yourself, if the president at the same time had been doing everything he could to get us off the oil tit, you know, no offense, but to get us off it, that would make sense if he was doing alternative power stuff and investing in what the Republicans think is, left liberal stuff like wind tunnel, windmills, and et cetera. But he hasn't done any of that. It's not an idiot question. It's a core question. And it goes to the essential science fiction aspects of these guys. I do think the only explanation is science fiction for their view of the world. It just doesn't make any sense. And not only that, the oil from Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia happens to be what they call very light oil. It's very easily treated, not a lot of impurities. And it's and for our uses in America, you know, the drive our SUVs and our guzzlers, it's perfect. It's really an easy fit, so it's the best oil. It's much better. For example, the Russian oil is heavy. We get offshore oil, some in California, some up in Alaska. It's very heavy oil that you have to treat with a lot of costs, a lot of money. Of course, at $90 a barrel, it's all profit. It's just inexplicable. It's another one of the inexplicable mysteries. That they would pick. I think they really did believe it would happen quickly, to be fair, the neocon mantra, that it would happen quickly and democracy would spread, as they said, like water flowing from a fountain, and that they could visualize. If you remember in the early days of the war, Rumsfeld was sitting after we looked like we won easily, which we did. I don't have to tell you, in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, the history has been when the Crusaders came to Iraq 1,000 years ago, they won immediately. They took over the country, and 2 years later, it's all written in all the various scholarship books. 2 years later, the Euphrates was red with the blood of the Crusaders, is what they would do it in the Arab literature. And in Afghanistan, the Brits, two times in the last century invaded, won right away, and immediately were driven off eventually by guerrilla warfare. So I don't know why they thought differently. There's no learning curve in America, but having said that, I think they thought they could. Rumsfeld, when it looked good, he was already talking publicly about going into Syria very early. What they're waiting for is for the other side to make a mistake. They want Iran to do something, cross the border and hit some Americans. they would settle in Lebanon. It's very tense right now. There's a tremendous standoff between a Christian and Shiite coalition against the Sunnis that we support. And they want no give. There's a lot of talk. There's an election coming up at the end of the month, at the end of November, late November. And the American position is no compromise on a candidate for president. And that could lead to a bloodshed there, which could also be a trigger for them. I don't know what's going to trigger us. We're going to do something that's reactive because you can sell it easier. And they've been trying to force Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, to do something. The game plan has been to get him to retaliate and be another militia, and so that we can really start a war there. It's just, it's really a total nightmare scenario.
Okay. Can I ask for questions?
Shoot.
There you go. Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sarah, for the speech. I wanted one quick announcement, and then I want to respond to what you said. I'm a member of the Irish anti-war movement, and we organized the big...
Quick.
And this is a demonstration on the 10th of November, 2 o'clock from the Central Bank, and I think everyone here should try and make it along, and I'll come back to that. The point you make about Bush and the neocons, I think, I'm not sure I quite agree, because it's often put in terms of Bush and the neocons taking over the American administration, but there is a logic to it. And when you have someone like Alan Greenspan, who's quite a central figure of the American ruling class, coming out and saying it was all about oil, it's a very obvious connection with what goes from Afghanistan to Iraq. And also, there is a logic to attacking Iran. And this is where the point that Olivia was making about the Democrats, they're as belligerent as the Republicans, because actually, behind the talk with Iran, there is the competition with China and Russia. So there's a very immediate and sensible logic from the point of view of the American ruling class, which they've been very candid about since the mid-90s in the Project for a New American Century. Is it just Bush or is it the ruling class? I think it is the wider agenda of the American empire.
Okay.
Let's take one at a time.
That's okay. Fair enough. That's worth, you know, I disagree. That's all.
Okay.
The American ruling class.
In case
you care, Houston is in a panic about Bush. In a panic. Because, as Olivia said, we're tampering with oil. What he's doing is counterproductive in terms of oil. So there's no right or wrong. There's just my view, and you can have yours. Go ahead.
I just wonder, can you tell me something? Is Turkey poised to invade Iraq for the Kurds?
Again, you know, if I could tell you that, I'd spend my time at the track. But I will tell you that we're extremely unpopular, the Americans in Turkey, which is a reality, extremely unpopular. And this is an issue that's brought the Erdogan government together with the military. And you know, they're not very friendly at all. The military hate the Islamists, but they're together on this. And I think we're going to do everything we can to hold them off. But we have certainly been, the Americans and the Israelis have certainly been playing very hard with the PKK. We've been using them in Iran for maybe three years. With the warning that they're not very controllable. And we're paying the consequences of that. I just don't know if it's going to happen, but if it does, look out. Yes.
You've quite beautifully demonstrated what Bush has done in terms of facts.
If that's your definition of beauty, you really have problems with it.
But concomitant to that, it's kind of created a space in which we're re-embracing the narrative of Orientalism. And that's kind of been twinned with the idea of the war on terror. And once we do rid ourselves of Bush and we move on to the next regime, do you think there's any way of recapturing that narrative so that policy decisions are not based on this very simplistic idea of East versus West?
What you're asking me is, will we learn from experience? Are we educable? Will we learn? And if you think it's possible for an American government to learn from the past, you're welcome to the bar, you know, the candy bar. I don't think so. I don't think we learn. I think anybody that can bounce from Vietnam to Iraq without batting an eye is just, it's really stupendously dumb. So, the idea, I think common sense would say we would learn something. But we're so primitive in America. I mean, you mentioned the word Hamas. Let me give you an example. 10 days ago, Condoleezza Rice comes and spends 2 days at least meeting with the head of Fatah, Abbas, and on this, you know, these alleged new peace talks. And in the American press, at least the press I saw, I don't think, at least in those 2 days, and I left right afterwards, I've been gone for a long time, for 10 days, 8 days, I saw no mention of the word Hamas. When you got to the European press, the second paragraph said, these talks, however, were not done with Hamas, which probably controls as much as 60% of the population, or that much support. So how useless. In America, it's just like Hamas doesn't exist. Hezbollah doesn't exist except for feigned terrorists, you know, bloodthirsty, blood-sucking terrorists. And so we live with all these, again, science fiction ideas.
Why is it so easy to make people afraid? Because that's what Bush has managed to do, isn't it? And he's trying to do it in Europe
because
now,
he's
talking
afraid.
About Iran
threatening
us.
He's afraid. He's terrified. He's afraid. That's why. Bush, Cheney's afraid. They're afraid. They live in bunkers. They travel in convoys.
But they're afraid of shadows.
Well, they don't think it's shadows. But, you know, I was in Syria, and the president of Syria, Bashar Assad, walks on the street. I will tell you this. He walks on the street. Sometimes with his wife, sometimes with the children, sometimes he drives. He doesn't have security. And there's no American president or vice president or, you know, or Cheney would dare do that. There's, you know, it's hard. And you say that and they would say, well, it's just a show. But it's not. It's just a different world. And I think the fear is, I told you, they're afraid of nuclear war in America, for which there's no empirical basis whatsoever.
Yeah, I was just wondering, what do you think can actually stop the conflict that's going on at the moment? Because you're saying the American people are very, well, you're saying Americans are, you're almost saying they're dumb. But at the same time, if you look at most Americans, they're against the war. And I think the only thing that can stop this war is by a lot of people getting out onto the streets and actually protesting against it and making their voices heard against it, which I think a lot of the American people are.
Well, let me make sure, be clear about that. I didn't say they were dumb. We're sort of, we're numbed, inert. We're not dumb. It's that we had over the vote show that was over 60% of the American public polls show are against the war in Iraq, and not one Democrat who's running for president can say that the obvious solution is to get out. You know what I always say about it's there's only two options for us in Iraq right now, given the fact that we're the 200 octane fuel that keeps it going. Option A is everybody out by midnight tonight, and option B is by everybody out by midnight tomorrow. And I'll tell you something. Eugene McCarthy in 68 was saying, we got to get out. And that's one reason I went to work for him. He's the only one saying it. If you remember, he did tremendous success. And then Bobby got killed, and he had some sort of incredible Jesuit guilt. God knows what happened. It's complicated. But in any case, I think the first American Democrat who starts talking on the basis of we've got to think about getting out as fast as possible, letting the tribal communities try and work. There may be a spike in violence, but can anybody say anywhere that in 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, it's going to be better? It's not going to be. And so the argument for getting out is overwhelming. Not one of the candidates has the guts to say it, and that's very sad. Al Gore could have said it, but he chickened out. And I think that's the word to use. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, which that was going to be a focal point in some of his earlier thinking about running. And then he just didn't do it. And I think he owed the Americans. As a vice president, he owed us a chance. He would have said it. He owed us the right to say it and to have us vote him in or out. Let's do some more.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, sir, for a wonderful experience this evening.
Wow.
Wonderful experience.
Are you into some sort of exotic SM or what?
I know a good thing when I hear it. In 2003, Ayatollah Khatami, obviously with the support of Ayatollah al-Sistani.
I didn't hear it. 2003.
He sent a memo.
Who did?
A manuscript. Ayatollah Khatami.
Yes.
Supported
the famous
by
memo.
Ayatollah
right.
Ali al-Sistani. Through the Swiss embassy.
Right.
To the Americans.
Right.
Where everything was on the table. No restrictions, no holdbacks, nuclear proliferation. Everything was on the table. Not alone did the Americans not have the manners to give them a reply. They chastised the Swiss authorities for allowing themselves to be acted as a conscience. Where would we be now if we got a more positive response to the goodwill of Khatami, who was trying to make overtures to the West for a long time?
Oh, that's you know, please don't be misunderstood what I'm saying. That's just a la-la question, because there was no way. But what the Iranians want, a couple of things from us. They want love. They want respect. They want some security talk about mutual security treaties, none of which were on the table. We're never going to do with this regime. It's just not where they are. In the science fiction of the Bush White House, giving respect to that regime is simply impossible. And what they want is they become, because of the war in Iraq, our war, they become the most dominant power in that part of the region. And they're perfectly willing, I do believe, they're willing, with the right terms, to work with us to resolve the crisis. Nobody wants chaos on the border. Nobody wants chaos on their border. It just makes no sense. It's totally destabilizing. And don't forget, Iraq and Iran did a lot of business together. And I'll tell you right now, most people don't even know it. There were over a million visitors from Iraq went to southern Iraq, from Iran went to Iraq last summer, in the last year. Tourists, they go to the religious pilgrimages, and a lot of the Iranians are buying property in the southern Iraq and sort of making investments. There's always hedge funds everywhere. And and they do over $1 billion worth of trade with southern Iraq. The Shia brothers, the two governments, do an awful lot of business. Every incentive is to negotiate. And you're exactly right about 2003. That's a description. There's an American named Flint Leverett that worked for the National Security Council who saw the document, who began talking about it about 2 years ago. And it's just one of the sad, sad things that they didn't do. Again, about Syria, in the first year of the war, Syria was our most important ally in terms of intelligence because the Syrians were, again, as I said, anti-jihadists. They had tracked the Muslim Brotherhood, and there was a long-standing connection between the jihadists and Muslim Brotherhood. There was some interchange. They're much different organizations, but they had intelligence we needed, and we got it from them. They cooperated with us all the way, in return for which they got nothing, just America.
Mind you, it's not a terribly attractive regime. And, in Syria? You know, in Iran, I was thinking.
Oh, no.
The president has talked about the Holocaust being a myth, and he's talked about totally getting rid of Israel. I mean, they're not necessarily the people you'd like to wake up next to in bed in the morning.
But on the other hand, Nikita Khrushchev went to the UN and took off his shoes and said, "We will bury you," to the Americans. Oh. Words are words. Ahmadinejad is the gift that keeps on giving for us. He's the best thing that ever happened to us. And I'm not clear what Larijani's dismissal means. I just haven't talked to anybody I know that knows something about it. None of us really, I have some people in Washington might have a better idea than I do. It could be a victory for Ahmadinejad, but there's all sorts of people waiting in the wings. Rafsanjani, he's got a lot of enemies. He's very unpopular. He hasn't delivered on any of the social programs and economic programs he said he would. And what the ruling, what the supreme leader thinks is not clear. Absolutely, there's no question it's a horrible regime. But you're talking to a government that we coexisted, we lived with the Chinese under Mao. We've had our Hitlers since Hitler. We have a Hitler every other year. We had Gaddafi, we had Mao, we had Stalin, we had Khrushchev.
We've had Saddam for a long time.
Yeah, and so you're right. It's a disagreeable regime, but that doesn't mean you pretend they're not there. Or Obama.
Okay, question from up here.
Yeah, sorry, Tom Clonan, Irish Times. Seymour, thanks again for coming and speaking to us. You mentioned the blowback, the price that America may pay in the future from the million or so troops that are returning from Iraq. 1 million of those troops at least have passed through Shannon. I've interviewed some of them myself. Do you think that the role that the Irish have played in facilitating the movement of the largest invasion army that has ever passed through Ireland, given our 900 years history with invasions and counter-invasions, will there be a payback for the Irish? Will people in the Middle East see that, you know, we've got blood in our hands?
Oh, you sweetie. I don't know. You know what? I pick my fights. I'm not going to pick this one. But, some of us still remember the Irish support for the Third Reich in the 30s. So, come on, we can go back. We can go back to there. The rendition program might be a problem. The rendition stuff might be a problem eventually. But I don't think we'll get to it. I think at this point, we're happy doing business with you, and thank God it's so great, and your IT people are wonderful, and let's just make money and roll together.
My children, they're Irish Americans, and I married a GI from the 101st Division. So my question is, the thing about Shannon, well, you answered that, but how is this affecting the American government and the semi-government on the deficit of this army that's not a hired gun no more, but taking on Iraq to go to Iraq? How is that affecting America right now in its deficit that's building with mortgages collapsing from semi-government ownerships and that? Is it affecting the economy in America?
Your point being strike in Iran is America going to involve a lot more military spending.
Yeah, can they afford it? Can America actually afford to fund themselves, or is it that what it's all about to get us and everybody else, like Shannon included? Can America afford to go against Iran, the government, and its people?
When you're talking about something that's messianic, I don't think the money issue. And don't forget, you know, every time the dollar goes off, you know, all the people that are holding our notes and bonds are losing money like crazy. Our foreign debt gets relieved. We've actually reduced our foreign debt by 40% in the last couple of years with the dollar collapsing. So this, you know, that's the way the Republicans look at it. They came with a $200 billion surplus, and look what they've done, the Republicans. It's really been a disaster, economic disaster, but of course he can afford it. Of course he can afford it. It's just he's not going to stop because of money. It's not his anyway. No, I mean that seriously. I don't think money is going to be a determining issue. Would Congress cut off funds? That's the better question. I mean, with all due respect, would Congress cut off funds? And the answer to that seems to be no.
Okay, we have a question here in the front.
Ah.
America has some of the best funded universities in the world. What, if any, moral leadership has been given by universities in this particular situation?
The anti-war movement that was so dominant, and it was started, you know, the famous University of Wisconsin demonstrations and the demonstrations from all the schools in the Northeast, has just not taken hold. And I think largely, to get to your question, you were asked the same question, I think largely because there's no draft. In the Vietnam War, we had a draft, and Bush will not draft. He's got a Praetorian Army. He's got a paid-for volunteer army. And I think it just hasn't clicked in terms of an issue. That doesn't mean the polls aren't consistent in showing that the Americans are increasingly against the war and increasingly skeptical of this president. I don't know whether there's some sort of, you know, unconscious sort of thing going on, but I have a sense that I don't think the demonstrations would change his mind. And maybe that's communicated in a way, too, that you can demonstrate all you want. It's certainly here, that famous Saturday demonstration shook up Blair. You know, I don't give him credit for much, but I give him credit for being aware that he was really in trouble. I wish I could figure out Blair. I can't. I can't figure out Brown either, so there. Yes, but the answer is it just hasn't caught. The universities have not led the issue. And we had the spectacle of the head of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger. I don't know what you thought of it, but I thought if he invites even a pernicious person as Ahmadinejad to his university, you don't denounce him. You don't do that. You can make your statement without making it personal. You can say we have disagreements with you about this and that, but the abuse he gave him only did Ahmadinejad, and it did him enormous good in the Middle East, and it also had a very bad taste. I speak to universities, and I sit next to, we call them presidents. Last week in California, early last week, I sat next to the chancellor of the University of California system at some event, and he was just really profoundly upset about what Bollinger had done, the American head of Columbia University who chastised. In the Middle East, as anybody knows who travels there, you don't insult your guests. It's just simple as that, and that overrides everything else, and he did something really stupid.
Though when you think back to the late 60s, it wasn't necessarily the heads of the universities who gave any moral lead, it was the students.
No, but I took a question to be, I can understand her focus with heads of universities, I do understand that, but I took a question to be the universities per se, the whole notion of universities. No, most university presidents would have to be hands-off. Are you kidding? The alumni would kill them if there were demonstrations.
You said that if a Democratic candidate were to promise to pull out all the troops...
Speak up, I'm so sorry.
You say that if a Democrat were to promise to pull out all the troops tomorrow, he would win the election. But given,
That's my fantasy.
Yeah, but doesn't... Given the vast permanent bases that are being built in Iraq right now, doesn't it seem that there's never going to be a full withdrawal? Surely those bases are being built to be...
Sure,
to be,
I mean, there's two main bases being built. And there's one, I hear, one secret base we don't know about, underground near Iran. I don't know if that's true or not. But there's two main bases now that we have. We've located at least two. There may be as many as four altogether, but two are really very big. And our new embassy, our billion-dollar colossus, you know, we could well see in a year, you know, Iraqis pulling all the copper wires out of all these buildings, you know, and doing what they do. I'm not sure that... you know, we've walked away. We walked away in Vietnam. We had something called Long Binh. It was basically a city warehouse, as big as a city, full of everything, refrigerators, television. And we walked away from all of it, helicopters and all that stuff. We can walk away. Okay, yes.
Neil Kahn might argue if you pull out of Iraq tomorrow, there's this huge bloodbath. What does your friends in military intel say would be the domino effect of an immediate withdrawal?
Well, when I say out of immediate, you know, get out today, get out tomorrow, that's of course, I'm just saying make the commitment to get out immediately. You'd have to do something to, here's the other side of the question, as I said earlier. Can you say it's going to get better? Can you say it's going to get better? And is it not so that at this point, believe me, if you think you can send the UN in, or any group of Muslim countries would volunteer to go in, anybody that comes in is an occupier. What happened to us in Iraq is very simple. We became the occupiers, and we became killing occupiers, inevitably, as occupiers get, you know, as we get more draconian in what we do. And so dislike for us is enormous. And I think until 2 years ago, I could have said this with enormous confidence. No question whatever happens in the short run, in the long run, it'll be much better. The tribes will take over. There's a huge tribal base there. And most of the tribes, yes, in Anbar, the tribes are largely Sunni, but most of the country, many of the tribes, Sunni and Shia. And the tribes will take over. There's a lot of oil. You might work out some system. At this point, I don't see anything but division on ethnic grounds, Sunni, Shia, Kurds. That'll cause a war. Because the Middle East, the countries in the Middle East will not stand for that. They're too frightened of that. There was a famous, what's his name, Moshe Sharat, I think. Sharat, in 1950, Moshe Sharat, S-H-E-R-E-T-T, I think, the Prime Minister of Israel, proposed on redoing the map. You know what Sykes-Picot was? After the Ottoman Empire collapsed, two European, Sykes and Picot, redrew the map. The map's the current Middle East. And the worry he proposed, the Israelis proposed a new Middle East. Greater Israel was a predominant figure in it, but also the rest of the Middle East would be divided into Sunni, Shia, Christian, you know, Maronite, divided ethnically. That was their proposal way back, and it scared the hell out of the Middle East. It didn't happen, and I don't think they'll let it happen again, and you could actually end up with extended war if this fallback plan, which seems to be the one that the White House is sort of acquiescing in sort of a passive way. So I'm telling you, it's not over. Pulling out, it just seems to me the faster we announce and declare our intentions, the better off we'll be. And because you could maybe get some. 2 years ago, I would have said for sure there was a strong chance. I don't know now. But what are you going to do? Stay there? The moderate force, the real glue, and this is hard to get your head around, it's Ayatollah Sistani. The religious leader of the Shia, he has been saying consistently since it looked clear after the war that the Shia community would emerge as the most powerful group in Iraq, he has been saying to the people, calm, stay quiet, don't vote in the elections, these dummy elections in which every one of the Shia voted only what their religious leaders told them to vote, as if democracy really meant much. All that purple thumb stuff was so silly. But, you know, it worked domestically. And vote in the elections, participate, do not go after the Americans because we win. This is our country now. And as long as he stays that, it's going to be viable for us. The moment, that's what makes our dancing around with the Sunnis in Anbar province so nerve-wracking for the Shia. They see us as beginning to renege on the commitment. You know, it's their country. That was the president said. Democracy, you know, plurality will win. And they were the plurality. They were 55 or 56% or whatever they were. At one point, they're probably greater now because so many Sunnis have left in terms of percentage. And so if we renege on that and he issues a fatwa, one of my nightmare scenarios is, and it's not only mine, it's others, he issues a fatwa in which he says to the 16 million Shia left in the country, all armed to the teeth, as everybody is in Iraq, go kill an American. What do we do then? What's our escalation point? What does the president do then in response to that order? What's his option? Nothing. Something horrible. I mean, I can give you a million scenarios that will keep you up all night. And so far, he is not. I can assure you that inside the Shia world, there's tremendous pressure to do something, to be more aggressive. And so far, this is just one of those little, stupid little facts of history that nobody pays much attention. In America, they don't even know who Sistani is. But we're surviving where we are because of that. And I'll tell you, let me just say one more thing. What scares some of the smart people I know is the British pullout. Because they're convinced that as long as the Brits are there in any province, particularly in the south, which is completely ungovernable by us or any western province, they're the hostages in case of a war. And he won't go to war. The president will not bomb as long as 2,000 Brits at some airbase could be seized the next day. And that's, I don't know if that's true or not, but I know there are people, serious people, who think that's, that the Brits getting out is not a good move because of that. You know, as long as they're there, they're a bar to us doing stuff. Last question. Isn't that terrifying?
Okay, not up here. Yes.
I'd like to know why somebody hasn't tried to impeach Bush before now.
To know what?
Bush. Why hasn't it been tried?
Oh, come on. They can't even decide the Democrats to how to end the war. They're going to impeach Bush and take that heat? No way. Not a chance. Not a chance.
Haven't got the courage?
They couldn't do it. They don't have a plurality. They don't have the votes. It would be a tremendous, be looking backwards. I'll happy dance son, you know, I won't finish that thought, I think it'd be crazy. I think you got to stay and look forward. And just, we have, 453 days, tomorrow will be 452, and just go day by day. This poor guy, I just have to ask this question. He's had his hand up for an hour. He must be exhausted. Go ahead. Yes, just say it.
How lucky is the word that it wasn't quick and cheap for the Americans?
How lucky was?
How lucky is the world that it wasn't cheap and quick for
Iraq. You mean that if we'd gone and been successful?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great question because, even though I couldn't understand it, it's a great it's a great question because it would have been, you know. In all of the neocon books, articles that were written, I was reading everything before the war began, all the stuff they put out at the Hudson Institute, all these crazy American Enterprise Institute. There was one paper that came so close, I was actually given it to by the head of intelligence in Lebanon, a guy named Jamil, who's now in jail as part of the conspirators, which he isn't, but it doesn't matter. The head of intelligence, right before the war in 03, I was in Beirut, and he, with great seriousness, he said, I've got something. He gave me a document that turned out actually to be a public document, although nobody knew about it. It was one of these crazy Richard Pearl right-wing friends, a guy named Marashevich or whatever his name is, I can't pronounce it, arguing why we had to do Iraq first and then Iran. And, you know, I think there was a game plan that was going to be in play. And Bush, for some reason, although he wasn't a neocon, signed into it. The initial game was win the war big, put in Chalabi. Remember Chalabi? Put in Chalabi, Ahmed Chalabi, running the government. Everything is happy. American oil companies, that's where you talk about oil. The American oil companies come in and let me just tell you about oil and this war being fought for oil. They will burn the oil fields before they let an American company in. And that, I'm just telling you that right now. The dislike of us is so across the board. They will burn the oil fields. I'm not saying a European country.
The Iranians.
The Iranians, the Iraqis. The Iraqis will burn any Sunni, Shia, you name it. They will not let an American company in there. Sorry, will not. I just think the blood is up. It's also up against us in Pakistan. Look, we haven't even talked about the real nuclear threat. 60 to 80 to 100 bombs in Pakistan. And we're still supporting a guy that's reviled by everybody there. That's still our guy. We don't even think about it in any logical ways. We could go on for 6 years doing this and make us all weak at the knees. Let's go home. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Seymour Hersh delivering this year's Amnesty International Lecture at Trinity College Dublin, October 24th, 2007. Thank you.
Bloody oil money, I'm above the law and I'll decide it's right or wrong. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Cuckoo, ca-choo, Baghdad City, policemen sitting pretty little targets in a row. See how they die when shrapnel flies, see mothers cry. I'm lying, I'm lying, I'm lying, I'm lying. Uranium, imaginary WMDs. They classify and fax, expose and secret agent tax. That's what the wealthy leave and all the poor behind. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Cuckoo, ca-choo.
I'm the decider.